You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend. And Tracy, we are back. It is the weekend after Memorial Day. How was your Memorial Day?
My Memorial Day was excellent. And in fact, I'm just going to put a pin in saying anything more about it, but to say my Memorial Day is going to be closely related to my pick of the week if we can fit that in for this broadcast.
Very cool. And our guest this week is Drew Murray. Drew, why don't you tell people who you are and what you do?
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show. I am an author of my debut novel coming out in just a few days on June 2nd. It is called Broken Genius. It is about a former genius Silicon Valley tech CEO turned FBI agent. And I'm really excited about it.
That's cool. And so your book is debuting the same day that this episode goes live.
Oh, there you go. Perfect.
Synergy. I blame Tracy.
Well, you know, I'll accept that blame. So I'm super psyched to have you on, Drew. I just got my copy from your publicist of Broken Genius in the mail about 4 days ago. So I'm just slightly ahead of the curve in terms of having that hot little ticket in my hand. So that's super exciting.
Fantastic.
And one of the things actually that I was thinking about as I was looking through your webpage and kind of getting myself oriented to like, how do we get the best out of Drew? How do we get the best Drew here? So I saw that you consider yourself an escape room expert. And I'm like, I have to know about this. Explain to me what does it mean to be a self-appointed escape room expert? Like, what separates you from the chum?
Well, it's a little bit of inside baseball because I started doing escape rooms at my wife's idea, actually, and we loved it. We did a bunch. And then being a writer, you spend a lot of time sitting at home I teach part time. So I had these vast periods where I wasn't seeing anybody. My wife said, you really need to get out of the house. So I said, sure. And what am I going to do to get out of the house? So I looked around and I got a job at an escape room.
Where you get to pretend to be trapped under other circumstances.
Yeah, right.
This is perhaps not what she meant.
but it was fantastic. It was a place called Trapdoor here in London, and it is not a chain. It's not a franchise. The owners designed and built everything by hand, like a theater set. And so it's fantastic. I get to, you know, chat with the guests before they play. And I get to watch them on the cameras as they play so that we can provide a timely hint if necessary. But as a person, I've had a long corporate career in management and I've studied team dynamics and interaction. And so it's been like a little laboratory for me to watch people play the game, knowing what I know about them before they go in the room, see how they interact in the room, see the choices that they make. And then when they come out, you know, ask them about it has been really fun.
That is super cool. And of course, because I teach writing and I'm a writer and Patrick's a writer too, my brain always goes to writer stuff in moments like this. So I gotta think that the human psychology element of how do we deal with stress and deadlines and urgency and incomplete information and puzzles had to have weighed into the whole approach that you have to your novel, to your character, to what he's going through.
Definitely. It's a thriller, but there are some heavy mystery elements in it too, because it's part of that puzzle aspect that I really enjoy. How is he going to figure out what's going to happen? What clues does he need to have? How does he manipulate those clues? Which is something that you get in an escape room. It's not just that you find something, you have to figure out what to do with it. So that played a great role in Broken Genius as I was writing it and as Will's solving the mystery of the book.
You know, the idea of the escape room, and I'm sorry to go back to that for a second, but
yeah.
At work, my boss is always talking about how much he loves this escape room that he went to with his wife. And he's like, he wants us to go as a team. So, you know, 11 of us going to some sort of escape room on our team. And in my head, I just imagine the normal way our meetings and discussions and team stuff go is that you'll have a couple of people say, well, this is the way we should do this and we should go like this. And you have some other people go, no, that's not really what we want. We want to go this way. And then other people going, I don't care. You guys pick. And it's just this huge, massive mess.
Cluster.
We'll just say mess. Yes. Yes. And I just keep thinking, you know, if he ever arranges an escape room outing for us, we're never going to escape the room.
The zombies will just eat all of you. And, you know, that in and of itself is instructive. You know, you could consider that like make that an HR sort of moment.
Absolutely. There was a military group that used our escape room as a training exercise. They had a mission. The mission was to escape. And then the commanding officer sat and watched on video camera to see how it unfolded and what did they do and what were the decisions they made and are they going to escape? Very different approach as opposed to, say, you know, like a family coming in, or my favorite, dating couples, especially early in the relationship.
Oh, no.
That's a fun event when that happens.
Oh, well, I think we should do this. Well, whatever you want. That's what we're going to do.
Surely you've seen an escape room based breakup. Surely.
Oh, I've seen, absolutely, seen, I've, they've left, and I thought to myself, that's not going to last the night.
Oh, man.
It's a pressure cooker.
So basically the escape room helped two people that probably shouldn't have been together escape the relationship.
I see what you did there. Yes. Yes.
It's not really about the room. It's about so much more than the room. Although, you know, it is, to be honest, the escape room concept, they're called escape rooms as sort of like a bucket to hold the whole play exercise in. But it actually encompasses much more than that. I was surprised when in the last week of school for my kids' school, I have a now 8-year-old daughter and 13-year-old son. My 8-year-old daughter, she's in third grade. She was given three different escape room activities to do remotely. And basically what it was scenarios where, like, you go on a field trip with your class. Oh, no, somehow you get left behind when the bus goes to leave. You have to figure out how to, like, keep yourself warm and out of trouble until the bus can come back and pick you up in the morning. Meantime, I'm thinking, like, wow, you're getting sued because I'm an American. But anyway, so each one of these, and they were all focused around a subject. Like, one of them was language comprehension, reading-based. One of them was mathematics-based. One of them was, I don't know, something else important. Like, this tells you how much I was really paying attention to it. But it was interesting because it was all arranged around a combination of, like, PDFs and Google Docs, where by doing certain quizzes or things, she would get certain answers to plug into certain other things that would allow her to move to the next part of the room, which wasn't really a room so much as a scenario. And once we kind of figured out some logistical difficulties of the technology, she was super engaged with it. And I think it says something about the level to which all of us want to do something challenging, even when there's not even really a need to encounter something challenging. We just sort of long for difficulty, but difficulty that feels like it's on a certain set of rails. It's not too threatening, it's not too dire, but it's still there.
Controlled danger, yes. Yes. And it's interesting as you describe how that those scenarios played out. One of the things that I found that makes an escape room the best kind of escape room is that there's a story to it. It's not just a bunch of puzzles thrown in a room and you know, one number leads to the next lock, to the next lock. The best rooms have a theme. They've got a story that you feel immersed in. There's a reason that you're doing what you're doing. And so, you know, your daughter's scenario of, you know, being abandoned by the bus, that's a gripping story that she's now immersed in. That's fantastic. I love that.
Yeah.
You know, I seem to remember there was a training video for kids. If they ever got left behind and left alone and had to survive on their own, I think it was called Home Alone.
Yeah.
Still that was the best.
Yeah, it was a very important part of, like, anyone, I think, of a certain age can be like, yes, I once sat up late at night and thought, if I were Kevin McAllister and the Wet Bandits were outside my house, what supplies could I use? And again, I think it's sort of like this is a weird phrase, but it's something that gets used in discussions between me and my friends sometimes, like when we're on panels or whatnot at different cons. There's a sort of subgenre, I think, of character situations or character types that writers have sometimes referred to as, like, competence porn. Where like the thing that makes a character super engaging is that they're just so freaking good at things. It's like they don't have to be sexy. They don't have to be, it's just that they're fundamentally good, not necessarily at everything, but like at something. And you're like, yeah, you program that thing. Like, yeah, you climb that building, or like, yes, you interrogate that suspect. And just, I think we get super excited about the fantasy of being an expert at something or of being skillful at something. And again, like the escape room thing, or even like reading a thriller can help us simulate that. We get to sort of sink into a situation where we get like secondhand competence.
It's true, especially when you think about Star Trek, and you know, they're always crews of super competent, super smart, super, you know, capable people, and it's just such a joy to watch, you know, as opposed to watching the news and seeing the real life world around you. So you get to go on that adventure with them, and you feel competent too. You feel like you can do this, especially when you read a mystery and you've got a mystery presented for you, and you're trying to solve it in your own mind at the same time as the protagonist is, and you feel smart because the protagonist is smart. You feel competent because they're competent, and it's a fun ride to go on.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because there's a couple of authors who have written epic fantasy, and they have had characters who make really bad decisions. And
as we all do.
And it's like watching a train wreck, and you can't look away. And I've talked about this before. There's been at least a couple of times where I've yelled at the characters in the books.
How That's dare excellent. You be this dumb?
And I had the opportunity to tell one of the authors about this, and it was Kate Elliott. And I had her on a podcast, and I told her, I said, you know, you wrote characters who made stupid decisions and had me yelling at them. And she went, oh, good.
No, I think
it's just the opposite of that.
So important. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you do have these competent characters, or these characters that you get invested in, and then they make a really stupid decision. And you're like, no.
And I think that the dividing line between it being a stupid decision that makes us hurl the book and not pick it up versus the stupid decision that makes us hurl the book and go, okay, fine, I got to see what's going to happen next, is whether or not, given what that character knows, given the way they usually behave, given everything that we know of their situation and so on, is the stupid decision that they made reasonable to them?
Like, yes. if it's consistent?
Right. Yeah. If you can look at that stupid decision and say, okay, all right, because I have this meta knowledge of the text that comes from seeing somebody else's point of view or whatever else, I know this is going to go horribly, but wow, like it is set up to do that. Then that's the difference, I think, between that sort of competence twist that you admire versus one that feels like this betrayal for the sake of plot.
Yeah. You never want to feel cheated as a reader, tricked into something.
No, definitely not. Okay, so this brings up something I want to hear from you gents about this. Can we do this in a way where we won't make enemies in the world of writing, where like someone did this in a way that truly worked for us? The competent character does horrible, stupid thing versus, no, this didn't work for me. This took me out completely. Like, now I'm wondering case examples.
Wow, that's difficult.
Yeah.
Oh shoot! I killed the cup. I killed the podcast. Better edit this out, Patrick. Tracy killed the podcast.
Well, I think when you talk about just a competent character that keeps you in, I mean that happens more often, I think. Mm-hmm. It's when the competent character, or like they're really good at something, but they also screw stuff up, right? Mm-hmm. And I the other one that I go to is Tad Williams.
Okay.
You know, the whole what's the epic fantasy? It's the Thorn. Oh God, I can't remember the name of it. It starts with the Dragonbone Chair.
Oh okay, yeah, I can't off the top of my head either.
There's a character in there. There's two characters in there who constantly. It's like the two main characters. They constantly make bad decisions. And you see, as the reader, you're like, oh, this is a character that's going to be really cool. They're going to do great things. But it's just like all of us. It's almost like, you know, they're going to college. They're going to screw up. They're going to do stupid things. And you just constantly see that, but you don't put the book down. You keep going. You're like, oh my God, this is the worst decision you've ever made. Why are you doing this? Okay, let me see. And you just keep going. Does that make sense?
And sometimes even if the decision itself, there's something about it where the character must know that this is going to be a call that's going to get them in deep water. If you love them enough, you'll go with them there because you're like, I want to be with you to hold your hand, character, when this goes terribly wrong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you can understand why they're making the decision they are, like, is it done with the best of intentions, even though you know it's a bad idea and they know it's probably a bad idea, but they're making a choice for moral reasons? Or is it a lack of competence because they have a big blind spot because of the nature of their personality, or the history that comes with them? So much of whether that's going to be successful or not depends on how richly the character's been drawn up to that point by the author. If they're a three-dimensional character, if they're believable, they have a background that we can sympathize with or at least understand, then when that character does something crazy, it seems almost inevitable. Like it was always going to happen that way.
Yeah.
Even though we're like, no, don't go down the stairs. You know, you knew from the minute that they walked into the building, they were going down the stairs.
Yeah. You were the type of person who goes down the stairs.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And again, it comes back to not wanting to trick the reader and have something happen, something make them go down the stairs. They were forced down the stairs and no, it's more interesting that they make the bad decision, because then they get a chance to redeem themselves from it. Then they have a chance to deal with the fallout. And then you hope that competence that they have pulls them out of whatever disaster that they have propelled themselves into.
There's something really bad going on in this house. Let's split up. I'll go into the basement. You go to the attic. Right.
That only ever works if you're on Scooby-Doo. Like that will turn out okay because there's going to be someone in a rubber mask who will have been foiled by those darn kids.
Unless Scooby-Doo is crossing over with Supernatural. Because in that episode, the shit was real and the kids got freaked out. I don't know if you saw that episode.
No, Supernatural's never been my thing. So this is a revelation to me.
Yes.
I did, but it was a long time ago.
Dean is obsessed with Scooby-Doo. He loves Scooby-Doo. He's obsessed with Daphne, of course. Dean being Dean. And they actually go into Scooby-Doo. There's a thing. They end up in the TV. They're inside an episode of Scooby-Doo. And of course, they bring their shit with them. And instead of it being rubber masks, it's real monsters.
Awesome. And they bring like the trunk full of weapons from the Impala with them.
I don't remember if they did that or not. I think they had to improvise. I don't remember.
Because, you know, that would really change the nature of Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, it would go from jinkies to something else real quick.
Yeah, and I mean, you're basically talking about, you know, PTSD for the kids, you know, for Fred and all of them, because they're just like, oh my God, what did you do? What did you do?
No, it's interesting. Supernatural's always been a great show for going meta like that. They had like a musical episode where it was about them in a high school musical.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, they don't just, you know, break the fourth wall. They twist it into a knot and play a song with it.
They found out there were books that was basically their lives that were being written by a prophet. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
They do that stuff all the time. It's a great show.
Meta things in storytelling.
I'm sorry, Tracy.
No, yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
Whenever we mention Supernatural, I do have to throw it out there. Angels are dicks.
I have heard that before. One of the things I always think about when we talk about meta storytelling things is how ridiculously hard they are to sell, in the sense of they have to be self-aware and mildly ironic, but at the same time, like, land a certain degree of sincerity. It's such a narrow tightrope to walk, but how super satisfying they are when they really kind of stick that landing. In a similar way, there's... you would see some of that same meta-ness in like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and in other their sorts of, I remember
Community.
The Angel. Yeah. In Community. I remember one episode of Angel, some curse happens and Angel becomes a Muppet.
Yes, you're talking about Smile Time, which is my all-time favorite episode of anything ever.
And
God.
And a significant part of like the emotional through line of Smile Time is like him being just a really aggro-looking Muppet. And, and this becoming a way of people being like, you know, your Muppetude might be saying something about you here.
My favorite moments in that episode, there's so many, but one of them is the hero walk. Mm-hmm. So that's something that started to happen in those kinds of shows, which is the very, you know, it's the slow-mo walk towards the camera.
It's the opening montage kind of deal. Yeah.
And they did that with the puppet walking with the sword across his shoulder and the other people behind him, like following him. The other one was Spike's reaction. Spike's reaction was hilarious, and then they're fighting over it, and Spike won't fight. He's just laughing his ass off the whole time as Angel the puppet is trying to beat his ass, and they're just laughing. And then the other one is when Angel's girlfriend at the time turns into a werewolf and starts ripping him up to shreds, and he's like, no, bad dog, no.
Which, you know, both works and doesn't work on certain levels of how to deliver a line in its context, yeah. Oosh. So this kind of takes us, I think we may be sort of edging in the direction since we've sort of branched out into larger fandoms and things which delight us. Is it too early for us to try and hit a pick of the week? What do you think?
No, I think that's fine. No.
All right.
Some music?
Yeah, sure.
Picks of the week.
All right, there we go. That always gets me in the mood. It helps me focus. I know what my job is now. So I was a terrible tease before when Patrick was just trying to be sociable and getting us opened by asking how my Memorial Day weekend was, and I said, nah, not until picks of the week, because for Memorial Day, of course, I cooked a lot. People who have been listening to the podcast for any time now know that cooking is a thing for me. But I was specifically breaking in some recipes from a new cookbook that I got, which, talk about meta-ness, is so deeply pleasing. Everyone must own this cookbook. The cookbook in question is written by Snoop Dogg. It is From Crook to Cook, Platinum Recipes from the Boss Dog's Kitchen. And I made Baby Got Back Ribs from it. And let me tell you, Snoop Dogg knows his business when it comes to making ribs. So if you are interested in accessing your inner nerd in, let us say, a different way than usual, and having the pleasure of reading a cookbook that is written in the vernacular of Snoop Dogg, that includes everything from fried bologna sandwiches up to lobster thermidor, the Boss Dog's cookbook is there for you, From Crook to Cook. Highly recommend.
The question has to be asked.
Yes.
About the ribs. Mm-hmm. What's the THC percentage?
There are lots of weed jokes in the book. Lots of them. But that particular recipe, no. There are, however, two recipes for gin and juice, unsurprisingly. Yes.
There you go. How did I not know that this book existed? When did this come out?
Computer main screen turn on. Give me answers. 2018. So it's had a minute.
Yeah.
It's been almost 2 years that it's been out. And it you know, it's got chocolate cake, it's got chicken and waffles, it's got an amazing cinnamon rolls recipe, it has his rankings of what are the best breakfast cereals to eat when you're stoned. you know, there's really something there for everyone. I want to say that it's an experience.
I love it. He's such an entertainer. I mean, he is. It's like you make the jokes, obviously.
Yeah.
Everybody does. But he does so many different things. It's not just that. It's not just the music. It's not just, you know, he's had the TV show. I know he's done a lot of movies and stuff. He's done acting. Mm-hmm. And now this. It's just, yeah.
And of course the foreword's written by Martha Stewart, because of course it is.
Of course. Yeah.
Well, they did that commercial together too. I don't know if you saw that.
They had a whole VH1, I don't think it was a series. I think it was just like a single like special episode that ended up like getting nominated for an Emmy that was called Martha and Snoop Dogg's Potluck Dinner. and it was just literally them in a movie studio, TV studio type kitchen, like making stuff together and being each other's sous chefs.
That has to be the oddest pairing ever.
Oh, like, my God. It's
on the surface of it, when you look at it, there's you think about those two people and you're like, what could they possibly have in common other than, you know, jail and weed? So, you know, fascinating.
There's so much stuff that's like very quietly between the lines of that introduction by Martha Stewart as well. Like, thanks to Snoop's guidance, I have learned so much about people who are different than me. And like, yeah. Yes, Martha, I imagine this is true.
Oh, wow.
There's really nothing in this book is a disappointment in any way, shape, or form.
That's awesome. Hey, Drew, what
That's
about you?
Definitely
you
going on the Amazon list.
Do you have a pick?
A pick? It's a Netflix show my kids and I have been watching. The whole family has embraced this. I mean, we're always starved for streaming entertainment in the pandemic, but... Lock and Key. That's what we've been watching and loving it. Absolutely loving it. The kids just they just gripped onto it right away, and we've been riding along and enjoying the twists and turns, and the special effects are good, and the soundtrack is surprisingly excellent. You know, we went out the kids and I and found all the songs, found the playlist on the internet, put them all into our Apple Music, and just loving the music to it. So it's That was a real surprise for me. I looked at the show from the Netflix ads, and it looked like it was going to be a kid show. And when I say my kids are, you know, 10 and 12. They're not little. And I thought it was going to be, you know, really, because of the one of the main characters is so young, I thought it was going to be a really kids-oriented show. And it's not at all. It's way more edgy and way darker, and we've just been loving it.
That's awesome. So I take it you have no exposure to the graphic novels?
Not before this. I mean, certainly once I became aware of what it was, I started to do my research and really geek out on it. And, you know, I want to know more. And so you're going to Wikipedia, you're finding the original novels, you're finding, you know, Easter eggs that are hidden inside the show. And I had not discovered the graphic novels before, but they're now on the reading list as well, along with the Snoop Dogg cookbook. So, yeah.
We are really just the gift that keeps on giving as a podcast. It's we're all about the people here.
Well, that's the point of Picks of the Week. It's just to bring other things to people's attention that they might not otherwise know about. I did read several of the graphic novels. I think I did it for Kirkus years ago. I have not cracked open that series yet. So it's good that you're saying that it's well done.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, definitely.
I don't know if you have a Comixology, Drew, but apparently right now you can get Lock and Key Volume 1 and Volume 2 through Comixology as one of their freebies. So.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, so that could be a place to start reading the source material.
This is the show that keeps on giving.
Yeah. And I love Comixology. That is a great way to just kind of keep up on stuff. I had it when they were doing most of the quote-unquote new Star Wars from Marvel was available right there. So I was able to catch up on a lot of stuff thanks to Comixology there. Like the whole Darth Vader series was really good that they did. And I liked the Dr. Astra?
Yes. Yes.
Was really, really good too. So lots of good stuff on Comixology. That's a rabbit hole you will go down and potentially have a lot of fun with.
I love rabbit holes, especially when we're at home doing social distancing. Rabbit holes are the best.
Yeah, they become more necessary. Yeah. All right. Well, I think it's your pick of the week time, Drew. I'm sorry, no, Drew. You just went with Lock and Key. We're so pinging around with Lock and Key. Now it's just all of us. Actually, it's just a cumulative pick of the week. So, Patrick.
So I was looking for just something I wanted something fun, and I have already actually watched this series, but I wanted to go back and rewatch it for a couple different reasons. So my pick, and I've recommended this before, I don't remember if I did it as a pick of the week, is Bob Hart's Abishola.
Oh, I don't know that.
This is a CBS show, and it's on CBS All Access if you have that platform. And it's Billy Gardell and a Nigerian lady whose name I will completely butcher if I attempt to even say it. I want to, it's like Folake, and then a long list of vowels and consonants that I'm sure mm-hmm. go together that I can't pronounce. Mm-hmm. She plays Abishola. And the premise is, if you know Billy Gardell, he was Mike from Mike and Molly mm-hmm. back in the day. He's a pretty big guy. And in the pilot, he has a heart attack and he has to have stents put in. And he wakes up in the hospital and here's a nurse that's standing over him, and it's Abishola. And she's very kind to him. She sings to him. She takes care of him. And he immediately gets a crush on her. And he just decides to pursue some sort of relationship. And he goes back to the hospital. He manufactures therapeutic compression socks. That's his business.
Okay.
And so when they first meet, he's like, "Can I look at your socks?" Which immediately creeps her out. She's like, "Excuse me, what? Why do you want to see my socks?" He's like, "That's my thing."
That is
like,
a weird socks. Question.
Yeah. So she shows him her socks, and he immediately identifies what they are, which kind of impresses her. And she's like, "How do you know so much about socks?" And he says, "Well, mine are better, blah, 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 blah. I'll bring you some." He brings her a bunch of socks, and that's kind of how they start to become friends. And the show has a lot of heart. Now, it starts off creepy, in my opinion, because he pursues her and at her job, right? Which I think is kind of creepy. It's like showing up at someone's job mm-hmm. and trying to get to know them. But what I love is they actually call it out, and he recognizes he sits there and he's talking to her and he's like, "You know, what I did was creepy." And she says, "Yeah, I know." He's like, "Well, I'm sorry, you know, if that made you uncomfortable." She's like, yeah, but let's move on. Okay. So they actually call it out that what he did is creepy. From that point on, it's two fish out of water, two completely different cultures. And they call it out. It's like, this doesn't work, but it does. And it's them kind of getting to know each other. It's her family. It's his family. At one point on their first date, their actual first date, his mother has a stroke.
Oh, no.
And Abishola helps with that because she's a nurse. And then he actually hires her to help with his mother's recovery. And so she kind of gets inserted into his family's life. And her family is already stalking him because they're trying to figure out if he's a good match for her. And it's just there's a lot of heart in this show. And so I rewatched it. They got hit by the COVID thing. So I think there's 19 episodes.
Yeah.
So they didn't get a proper finish, but they got a second season. So second season is coming. So
okay.
I still like this show. I like the contrast between the two cultures. It's set in Detroit. Her family are all from Nigeria. His family is very almost Chicagoan in their Midwestern accents and stuff, and just the way they talk. It reminds me of Chicago, where I was born and where Tracy lives. It's just a good show. It just has a lot of heart. So that's what I keep going back to. I wanted to have something right now, given everything going on in the world, that was just a little bit more happy and uplifting. So that's what I watched.
That makes sense. And do they approach it really from a heavily comedic aspect?
Yes.
Or is
it a
drama?
Yeah. No, it's a comedy. So it's a sitcom. It's a sitcom. Yeah.
Because, you know, Stroke on the First Date seems a little dark, but, you know.
Yes. And it, the way they kind of handle it is his sister, he has twin siblings. His siblings are twins. And so his sister calls him and says, "Mom's slurring her words." And he's like, "What, you called to tell me mom's drunk?"
Oh no.
And Abishola immediately like clamps on and says, "Point to an object and tell her to tell you what it is." And she can't do it. Like she's saying something else. Oh. And she's like, "Okay, can she lift her arms? Can she do this? Can she do that?" And Bob's like, "What are you doing? What's going on?" She says, "I think your mother's having a stroke. We need to get her to the hospital immediately." Yeah, and so it's just like and what you see is her culture, you take care of your elders, you take care of your family. Family is very important. And so what she sees in Bob is that he is taking care of everybody. He's taking care of his brother and sister. He's taking care of his mom. That appeals to her. Even at the same time, Bob's like, "This is a pain in the ass. I'd love to get all these people out of my house. I'd love to get my mom, you know, back on her feet. And I'd love to get my brother and sister out of my house so we're not all having to take care of her." And so there's just this, it's just fun. It just really is. And there are some deeper moments in there, but I still maintain that it's a show that has a lot of heart. And that's what I was looking for.
Wow.
So there you go. There's my pick.
There you go. Well, so this is quite a variety pack of picks of the week.
No kidding. Kind of went all over the place there. Yeah.
We always do.
Yeah. So as we're kind of coming up on closure here, Drew, I want to make sure that we give plenty of time for you to talk to us one last time about Broken Genius, talk to us about who is it really for as a reader, what have they got to look forward to in it, and where are the great places that they should be shopping to get a copy of it?
Oh, definitely. One of the fun aspects of the book and who it's for that I've really been connecting with online is, you know, I have to do now that I can't go anywhere and visit anybody, is the geek community, because it's set at a Comic-Con. So the bulk of the action takes place at a Comic-Con in the Midwest. And there are many, many different references to many different fandoms. And that's all in the book. And it captures really the essence, the spirit, that positive spirit of being at a con. So for people that can't go to a con this year because they've been canceled, this will help you get your con fix until we can get back out there again in 2021.
Excellent.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And as far as where you can buy it anywhere. You can buy it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, you name it. It's everywhere books are sold.
Do you have an audiobook?
Not yet. Okay. That is something that the publisher is considering for the future.
Gotcha. Okay. I know a lot of our listeners like the audiobooks. That's why I bring it up.
Right.
Definitely. Definitely. Right. Yep. There's an ebook and a paperback, or rather a hardcover right now.
There you go.
So if our listeners want to keep up with you, to keep an eye out for the next book, to hear about your next interview or something, where should they follow you if they're looking social media, web, etc.?
Absolutely. On Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, it's Drew Murray Books. So just at Drew Murray Books. And my website is drewmurraybooks.com, and I've got a blog there, and any announcements about where I'm going to be appearing and articles that I've written show up there as well.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for being with us, Drew. You were a great guest.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was great.
All right, folks. Have a great week, Functional Nerds. We'll see you next Tuesday.
Hey, we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Functional Nerds podcast. If you're looking for other great podcasts to listen to, I recommend Beyond the Trope. They premiere new nerdy episodes every week. Giles and Michelle have piled up over 7 years worth of interviews with best-selling authors, award-winning actors, and other leaders in the creative community. And even though, I mean, they've sincerely disappointed me by not coordinating a meet and greet with every dog they know, their Patreon supporters and fans love them for keeping their weekly episodes short, sweet, and full of laughs. Check them out over at beyondthetrope.com. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, consider becoming a backer of the show over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. We have all new levels with some fantastic rewards like access to our patrons-only Facebook group, exclusive extra shows and content like the new video podcast, Just 10 Minutes, book giveaways, yep, we're giving away books, and even short story critiques provided by Tracy every month. If any of that sounds good to you, again, visit patreon.com/functionalnerds. This podcast is copyrighted by the Functional Nerds under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. To learn more about the Functional Nerds, visit functionalnerds.com.